If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Halloween version of the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And we thought to scare you, we'd bring in the Inno boys, as we do most Mondays. Will Dahlke and Jim Flanagan, welcome back.
Oh, nice,
flip those up, yeah.
So we were just talking off the air. You guys are still kind of doing Halloween once in a while, did the parties. And
I'm not going to stop. Why stop?
I just stopped and loved it.
Yeah, you finally grew up, huh?
I don't know. It was the first year I didn't go all out and do Halloween, and it was kind of nice to.
So, do you watch Peter Pan then, Will? Is that what you.
Yeah, sure. Cover tech. There's a lot of promising stuff out there. You know, start reverse aging.
That could work.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, the Cubs are still going on, and Jim's got his Cubs hat on, and this World Series has moved out of the city now, and until next year. But you guys have a story up about parking. You know, everyone's talking about tickets and all of that stuff. But there's this parking app. It's called
Park X,
where you can rent out your own little garage or things like that, right? This has been a boom for them.
It has. And, yeah, you can think of Park X kind of like Airbnb for parking. So, basically, people who are renting or owning a place, they can rent out their parking spot for someone else. So, a lot of apps will do where to find street parking, where to find garage parking. This is where to find private sort of residential parking. And it's been a big boom for the World Series. A lot of folks around Wrigley Field have been renting out their parking spaces, and they've seen this this app, Park X, has seen a huge jump in number of people who are using the app, who are posting their spaces, and some spaces even going for $250
to park in some guy's garage.
Exactly.
Now, I know that they closed a lot of the streets in the area, right? But you could still drive in and park in people's garages?
Yes. If you could get past the street closures and get to some of these residential places, yes, they were making between $50 and $250. So pretty cool. They said they saw like a 400% jump in number of spaces posted around Wrigley.
Yeah, and what's funny is another Chicago parking startup. Unbelievable, right? Like, this is, we are becoming a hub for parking innovation. We have ParkWiz and Spot Hero, two of the most funded startups here in Chicago that do on-demand parking. And what makes ParkX differently is when you think about it. So what ParkWiz and Spot Hero do is they take demand off the market. They are working with parking garages to help you find where there's an opening. What ParkX does is they add demand to the market. And that's a very kind of universal trend in tech, is you have all of these startups and apps that are helping users kind of look at their life and monetize their value, value that they don't even know they have. I'm in a building that came with a parking spot. I sell it for $175 a month. That's value I wouldn't have had.
Right.
And it's a cool kind of tech trend. It's like, what do you have in your life that we can kind of take a little fee off of? Here you go.
It's an extension in a way, or if you'll allow this, of eBay.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in eBay, people started going through their basements and attics and selling stuff that they already had. And here's a parking situation or others like that where you've got something that is of value to someone else and you might as well make some cash off.
Yeah, I always thought, speaking on that, like when you look at all of these clips of like Murphy's Bleachers and all these bars in Wrigleyville, when you think about really expensive real estate, I wish there was an app that allowed you to, if you got there and got on a bar seat early, you could then like
you could
sell that bar seat for, you know, $100, so you could come
later. I think you're onto something.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
Well, that'd be a dog thing to do to Murphy's, because they were one of the only ones not charging, I think, $250 to get in.
Oh, really? I thought, yeah. I mean, I saw some of those cover charges, $150, but
okay,
yeah,
so there's that, and of course, we're in the midst of this very long World Series where everyone is trying to find an angle.
Yeah.
Which brings us to this legal tech company. Is it K-Cura?
K-Cura, yeah. Now, one of the fastest growing startups here in
the
city.
What does it mean to be a legal tech company?
So what they make is they make e-discovery software. Now, what e-discovery software is, software that helps lawyers and litigators go through vast amounts of documents and find the right things. And you think like, oh, so that's kind of like Google. Yes and no. I mean, when you get into law, there's such specifics and complications. So they really created the product, e-discovery software. So they have, I believe, 600 people here in the city. I mean, they're a super fast-growing tech company, and they announced as part of the World Series to get in on the action that they're going to be creating 108 new jobs in honor of the Cubs. Now, they were going to be releasing their hiring projections anyway, but why not come out a little early and add one or two more jobs to get to 108? So they were going to be making this announcement, kind of a fun way to tie it into the Cubs.
Right, but they're not troubled by the fact that 108 represents a lot of futility.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't take 108 years to hire these 108.
I hope the number works better for KQR than it has for the rest of us. All right, so we'll follow that. I was talking to Bill Leff before the show started about an app that you guys write about as well. Jim, this is one of your stories about Dine Hero. And there's got to be more to it than this. But essentially, it's, you know, if you're going to go out for lunch or something like that, you don't want to eat alone, you can create this lunch event, and someone who sees it can join you.
Yeah, you can kind of think about it as like a Tinder, but not for dating. It's really for networking, really. So it's an opportunity for young professionals new to a city, business travelers, anybody who's kind of, you know, sort of out in a new city kind of alone and has an opportunity to grab a bite for lunch or dinner and doesn't want to do that by themselves. And thinking about it in terms of networking, right? So the app will match you with people who maybe went to the same school as you or were in the same field. And basically two people or four people can get together and grab a bite to eat to kind of network and talk shop. And basically better than being in a new city and eating alone.
This is one of the reasons why I will never be a successful businessman, because that would scare me to death. I mean, just, you know, I'm not one of those guys who can, I have friends who can sit down with someone and become lifelong friends with them in 10 minutes, but just to... I'd rather eat alone.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, some people are just, you know, career networkers.
Right.
Oh, they want to network, network, network. And what this app does is it gives you a bit more of a richer networking experience than your typical, you know, happy hour event where you might bump into somebody for a couple minutes.
Well, let me tell you. So I, not to interrupt, Will, but last week I did a speaking thing at Waherty & Davis. It's in an accounting firm up in Skokie area. And, you know, I did my little spiel. And then when I was done, all these guys who were there, I looked around like, what are you doing now? And they're just, you know, talking, introducing. And I'm like, yeah, I got to go. Cubs are on. You know, it's just not my thing. But I know that's how people make connections.
Yeah, well, that's a segment, too, of social media that is, like, kind of untapped, right? When you think about why social networks are created, it was to stay in touch and connect with people already in your network. These are my friends. Now they're my friends online. And then, obviously, there are the connections that are relationship-based, like all of the dating apps. But there's really that none of that kind of middle ground where this is an app to forge a platonic relationship.
Right.
I was new to the city 6-7 years ago. My wife and I like went on friend dates. We wanted to find friends. And
were they blind dates? No,
I mean, it was my cousin knew this guy and put us in touch. And there's no app for that. So I like the idea of this kind of middle ground where it's like, no, this isn't a date. This is just to build my network in a city I'm unfamiliar with.
That's Will Flanagan, general manager of Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke is here as well. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk about Groupon and its relevance, not just then, but now as well. Steve Bertrand here on The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke are in the studio as well. You guys know Simon Winchester?
Krakatoa. Professor in the Madman.
Yeah. But, Professor in the Madman. So he wrote a book called Atlantic a few years ago that I interviewed him and loved. And then he's got a new one. It's just out in paperback called Pacific. So I had a chance to talk to Simon last week. We're going to play part of it later in the show. But what's most interesting to me about it was the Madman and the Professor, right?
Yes.
He sold to Mel Gibson. He sold the movie rights. And he did it before Mel Gibson had all these sort of meltdowns. So now here's this artist, author, tied to a guy who's a very different entity. And he's going to Dublin next week. Actually, they're filming the movie. So
interesting. Could be worse, right? Could have sold it to, like, Charlie Sheen.
Well, yeah, he might have. So we'll talk to him about that in the second half hour. Well, let's talk, Jim. You wrote a nice, extensive sort of look at Groupon. Because, you know, we pick on Groupon sometimes, and I think we tend to overlook. It's like a relative who we tend to undervalue sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's true. Groupon's stock price has gone down a lot. It's sort of very infamously turned down a $6 billion offer from Google.
And I did too, by the way.
It's had a lot of turnover at the top. And it kind of draws snickers in the tech community pretty much across the board. But we kind of want to take a look at Groupon's significance, influence to Chicago tech sort of beyond its stock price. And Groupon was really an influential tech company in Chicago in terms of really ushering in a startup culture that really didn't exist here. Tech, of course, was in Chicago, tech jobs have been around here for decades, but there wasn't that like quirky startup culture really until Groupon got here. And you forget that back in 2010, Groupon was the fastest growing company ever. I mean, it reached a $1 billion valuation in just a year and 4 months. I mean, when everything is happening in Silicon Valley and all eyes in tech are going on what's going on the West Coast, Chicago had the fastest growing rocket ship in tech.
So it was a fun rocket ship. It was quirky. It was weird. It was paying its employees well. I remember when I first moved to Chicago, they were paying copywriters $50,000, $60,000 a year. No one was doing this. And this was a fast growing startup that had ping pong tables everywhere. And they had a room for a made up guy called Michael. And they would bring in horses and monkeys. And it wasn't just a rocket ship. It was fun. It was like hearing all of these stories about things going on in Silicon Valley happening in the backyard. So when we talk about influence, what happened is it wasn't just, okay, I'm joining a fast-growing company. It inspired people to think entrepreneurially. Right now, there are over 100 people who list themselves as founders on LinkedIn here in Chicago who had experience at Groupon. Now, that's not to say...
So people who worked at Groupon who went on to be founders.
Went on to be founders. So that's not to say that they all wouldn't have been founders on their own, but we talked to a lot of people who said, yeah, Groupon really inspired me to think entrepreneurially and try something.
Okay, well, we just have to touch on the one thing that the guy in the tutu. You're talking about culture, and Jim writes about this guy in a tutu at the office.
Right. So startup culture is that kind of thing where it gets a lot of eye rolls because people think that startup culture is just ping pong tables and foosball tables and beer in the fridge. But the way Groupon thought about culture was so different. They brought in improvisers across the company to have a quirky atmosphere. And one thing that the founder, Andrew Mason, did was he basically built a room inside Groupon's offices that was called Michael's Room, and it had a bed and a desk and a toilet and a bike that played music when you rode it, stationary bike. And basically the rumor, as the story goes, that Michael lived there before Groupon got there, and then Groupon moved in and he stayed there. It was just so weird. Bizarre and quirky and weird, but like that was totally the culture that existed at Groupon.
Tutu.
In the tutu. So,
right? Wasn't there a guy who hung out?
Andrew Mason hired a guy in a tutu to stand in the office for a week and draw in a notebook and not say a word to any of the employees. And he would just stand there for a week. And that was just kind of like a way to cut through the monotony of the day-to-day and have a different atmosphere in the workplace.
And you also think that Groupon, that's the other thing, like it was a real Chicago business and that it had Chicago in its DNA.
Right.
This is a funny city. It's a storied comedy city, and it was built on a lot of that humor. A lot of its copywriters were part of the Second City community. So it really kind of built, it was a not just a great tech story, but it was a great Chicago story. And one of the reasons we get frustrated when Groupon is kind of talked about is you focus on the fact that this fast-growing business didn't become Facebook. Yeah, okay, but guess what? It's not MySpace. It still employs over 2,000 people here in the city. It generates over $1 billion in revenue a year. Like, this is not oh, remember Groupon? Like, they're still around
they're
and still doing good business.
And they're pivoting, right? They picked up Living Social, and they're going more toward an online retail sort of presence.
Yeah, so they're becoming more of a holistic e-commerce company. So less reliance on the daily deals and more kind of a platform for goods. And this was a business they got into about 3-4 years ago. So last week, they acquired Living Social, its former rival. You know, Living Social had a valuation of $1 billion. Groupon got it because they pivoted earlier than Living Social did.
That's Will Flanagan, the general manager of Chicago Inno. Jim Dulkey is here as well. Thanks, guys. And Will, if you want someone to hire to hang out in your office in a tutu.
Dan, I already do that, but we need to.
I was thinking more of Michael Heideman, the producer. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's not just a Monday. It's a Halloween business lunch. And Randy Schaefer writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune, joins us in the studio. Randy, welcome to the business lunch.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you. We've talked a few times off the air, but it's nice to have you on the program.
It's nice to be here.
Halloween, all about costumes and all of that, right? And so one of the things, and I don't get this at all, but so there's a movement in costumes to be sort of the here and now. Right? You're not dressing
right.
up, except maybe around here like Andrew Hamilton, but more here and now and more sort of relevant. And so the Snapchat filters have become a popular costume.
Yes, they have.
You're going to have to spell that out for me.
Well, pop culture references have always been a big deal in Halloween costumes. And now not only do we have pop culture references, we have social media references. And so while social media has kind of viralized things like Katy Perry's Left Shark as a costume a few years ago, now social media itself is getting its place in the spotlight with things like Snapchat Halloween costumes. The app itself has some really fun filters on it today. You can take a selfie and slide and make yourself look like a devil or whichever Halloween costume you'd prefer. But a lot of people, digital is not enough. And so they are actually creating Halloween costumes based on the app.
So that's what we're talking about. So the filters are making you, sort of giving you a digital costume.
Yes.
And so people are saying, well, that's nice, but now I really want to look like a cat.
Right, right.
So you not can just a cat, but a Snapchat
right,
cat.
Right, right. So you can do the digital filter for work if your office is a little
right.
not cool with costumes.
And the people who actually try to dress up like a filter, are these people who really never get out of their house?
I wouldn't say they never get out of their house, but, I mean, I have seen a lot of these pictures on my feed. So they're going somewhere dressed up as flower crowns and pieces of toast.
That's pretty fascinating, really, if you think of it, that people are dressing up as sort of a costume in a way.
Right, right. Yeah, a costume of a costume.
Right. Okay,
say.
So that's Snapchat. Which filter will you be going out as tonight?
Oh, good question. I haven't thought that far ahead, but luckily a lot of them are easy enough that you can just kind of pop on a butterfly, little butterfly pin or a flower crown and be out the door and trick-or-treating in 20 minutes.
So all right, well, we'll see. If anyone comes to your door today dressed as a Snapchat filter, you know, ask about their parents and the presence they have in their lives. Okay, let's move on to, because there was a story last week, you know, Twitter purchased or took over Vine some time ago, and then they announced last week that they were, you know, cutting Vine. They were going to get rid of it. And I'm not as attuned into that as a lot of people are, but I thought that was going to be huge news. And I sent it right away to my kids. They're both in college. I'm like, hey, Vine is going away. And neither one of them seemed to be that worked up about it. I mean, was this not a big deal?
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, actually, how many people aren't terribly worked up about it. A lot of even self-professed Vine stars, these kids that have become famous, some of them have actually even had spin-off TV shows on Disney Channel. They're not even that worked up about it.
Let's explain just, Randy, real quick what Vine is, though. These are like these 6 or 7 minute videos?
Yeah, Vine allows a user to create a 6 second looping video, which kind of has an extended Instagram boomerang feel. You start the video, 6 seconds, it starts it again, 6 seconds, and it perpetually goes on and on. Really annoying if you leave your phone unattended, but it's a good amount of humor in 6 seconds, and a lot of kids have kind of turned this into their own little mini TV series of sorts.
Well, it's kind of cool because they've developed sort of followings and real characters. So there's young people who've made $1 million or more with some.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know. I was just reading this morning that one of the top Vine stars made $13 million in a year just based on this app. And so while you think that a lot of them would be concerned that it's shutting down, a lot of them actually aren't. Over the past year, many have migrated away from Vine itself to Snapchat and to Facebook and YouTube, these sites that have bigger followings where they can get more exposure, and they've started raking in higher endorsements there. So a lot of them are pretty...
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's crazy. And so a lot of them are grateful that, you know, they were able to turn this short-lived app into a full-fledged career, but a lot of them aren't as devastated as you might think.
So is it that Vine has served its purpose and it was over, or that they can move on because what Vine was offering them really isn't that unique, that they could do that at Snapchat or Instagram as well?
I think that a lot of social media services aren't necessarily unique anymore, as we've seen, you know, with Instagram taking Snapchat stories.
I mean, Facebook Live is just, you know, they're
right.
advertising that heck out of the World Series right now.
Right. So you can take one app can make something and a bigger app can take it and the audience is there. And for these kids, they want to go where the money's at. They want to go where the numbers are at. And you can't really blame them.
It's pretty amazing. And, you know, that Facebook Live thing, their timing is terrible because there was that guy in Oklahoma who killed two family members last week. And then was doing Facebook Live postings. Police got him finally last night. But every time I would see a commercial for Facebook Live at the World Series, I'm like, it's not working out so well.
Never know what you're going to see.
Speaking of Facebook, and, you know, you can check into locations, right? That's one of the things that one of the many things with social media that I've never done or don't do. but there was this complaint or worry that there's the big pipeline protest at Standing Rock, and I think it's in North Dakota, right?
Yes.
There were people saying, hey, the cops are looking at Facebook check-ins to see who's here and who's protesting.
Right.
So tell me about that. Is that fact? Or are they still checking that out? Do we know?
I love relying on Snopes for stuff like this, where they go through and they check out the validity of these things that get circulated on the internet. And Snopes said that it's still looking into the issue as to whether or not authorities are using Facebook check-ins to target protesters at the Standing Rock Reservation. But regardless, the internet's going to do what the internet wants to do. And so these check-ins keep coming. And what this is people that are standing in solidarity with protesters are checking in, air quotes there, on Facebook to say that they are at Standing Rock in order to distract the potential authorities that are looking at these posts.
So if I wanted to stick it to the man, I would go on Facebook right now and check in that I'm at Standing Rock.
Yes, but you would do two posts. You would do it in two posts. The trend that seems to be going on, one post is public, and that's the check-in. And the second post is a private friends-only post that explains what the check-in is for and what's happening. And no, mom and dad, I did not accidentally jump on this flight to North Dakota last night.
I'm not really hugging a pipeline with Jill Stein.
No, I'm not really.
So we don't know. Now, how would Facebook react? I don't mean to put you on the spot here. If the police were to do that, I mean, if I'm a copper and we've got trouble with these protesters, and I've got an easy way to figure out who's there, it seems like the sort of thing that I would do, and I would feel justified in doing.
It seems like it, but to be honest, I'm not entirely sure, and I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how this situation pans out and see if all of these false check-ins have had any sort of impact on the alleged authority, going in there.
Gathering their evidence or whatever.
Yeah.
We got time for one more. I want to talk. So John Cass is calling on Hillary. Now, this is John Cass, who is is he outside? No. Sometimes he's standing outside the window. So I have to be careful what I say. No, but, you know, John's a conservative, I would say curmudgeon sometimes, or, you know, he always tends to see a conspiracy in things where he often does. And he says that Hillary Clinton should resign over this email thing. Okay, well, that's John's his opinion. He's a great columnist, and he writes that. But what we're seeing today now is how someone who can write something, and then it gets sort of turned.
Right. And this kind of goes back to with the Standing Rock check-in thing, Snopes being a big thing, is to always, no matter what you're posting, check the source. And what happened with this was Tribune columnist John Cass wrote a pretty provocative piece voicing his opinion that the Democrats should remove Hillary Clinton from the ballot. And a few alt-right weeklies picked up on the piece and spun it to say that, rather than Tribune columnist John Cass says, spun it to say the Chicago Tribune says, which is not at all the case.
So when you read some of these things, you just have to look a little closer, read a little bit more tightly, and to see what's true.
Right.
Randy Schaefer, it was great to meet you today. I hope you enjoyed it. Maybe we'll come back next week.
Yeah, definitely.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Well, Secretary of State Kerry was in Chicago last week talking about the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. President Obama has long talked about a pivot to Asia for the United States. It seems like a good time to welcome Simon Winchester to the program. His most recent book is called Pacific, now available in paperback, and he is a longtime friend. Simon Winchester, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Well, thank you very much.
This follows Atlantic. And when I read Atlantic and enjoyed it, I felt I knew a little bit more about Atlantic going in than I do Pacific. And I wonder if that's your opinion as well, that we Americans maybe don't have as good of understanding of the Pacific region as we do with the Atlantic.
I think that's generally true. Because the sort of intellectual hub of America is it not between New York and Chicago?
This is a business show, and we talk a lot about, you know, we are in a time of disruption in so many different industries. But in this book, Pacific, you sort of tell the story of the region with 12 different chapters, essays. But one of the ones that I think applies to us here is the story of Sony and the way they were disruptors or the way they started. And you open it by talking about the devastating situation in Japan and Tokyo after World War II. Tell me about the two men who brought us Sony.
It was quite extraordinary, really. You've got this rather suave, wealthy heir to a rice and sake fortune called Akio Morita. And you've got his chum who worked with him on a naval technology program in the closing years of the war for the Japanese Navy, a missile engineer called Masaru Ibuka, who was the very opposite. I mean, where Morita was smooth and plausible and well-dressed and rich, Ibuka was an engineer with dirt under his fingernails and pebble-thick glasses and a shambling manner. He looked like a great big bear. But he was an inventor, right, par excellence, and he invented all sorts of amazing things. The first invention, which the two of them got together immediately after the war with a bit of capital from the rice fortune, which the accountants of the Morita family reluctantly handed over to them.
They got him drunk.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't want to go into all the details, but yeah, they got him drunk, which is a common feature of Japanese business life, of course, was they made a rice cooker, basically, if you imagine those bamboo sort of wok that you get at Chinese restaurants, with an aluminium, an aluminum pad at the bottom of it. And when the rice was wet, in other words, when it was mixed with water, it would conduct electricity, it would be heated by this pad, and because it carried an electric current, and then once it was cooked, it would go dry, cease conducting, and that would make it switch off automatically. A very clever idea, but it just didn't work. But then they got it right, and the thing that they got it right with was in 1954, a transistor radio. They made effectively the first ever, and it was invented by Masaru Ibuka. It was called the TR-55.
It was done because Bell Labs was looking for a partner for their transistors? Is that
right? Yeah, that's exactly right. And very cleverly, in a meeting in New York with the Japanese investors on the other side of the Pacific, very nervous about entering into any kind of agreement with the former enemy and spending money, licensed from Bell Labs the transistor. And what the Bell Labs transistor was, a big clunky thing. And what Masaru Ibuka did is he refined it using a particular technique called phosphor doping to make it much smaller, much more efficient, and able to transmit or to generate, if I can use that rather crude word, more power, enough to produce volume in a radio set. And they made this little radio, which was not much bigger than a packet of cigarettes. And up to that point, I don't know if you were alive then, I certainly was, a radio set was a piece of furniture. I mean, it was...
Sure, absolutely.
Made of walnut, and it stood in the corner and had an aspidistra on top and a doily, and you turned it on, it warmed up, and you listened to it. But now, with this little thing, you could take radio, you could take entertainment, you could take the Cubs games or whatever, out onto the patio and by the swimming pool, to bed, to class, to wherever you wanted it. And it completely changed the paradigm of entertainment. And these things, these little radios, 50 of them were sent initially to Canada, sold like hotcakes. 4,000 then appeared in New York at a Delmonico's warehouse, were stolen.
When that was, I wanted to get to that bit of serendipity, because some of these stories have that. Because of that theft, they became much more nationally known.
Well, because bless the New York Times, it reported the fact that when the burglars broke into the Delmonico's warehouse in Queens, it was an electronic warehouse full of, you know, irons and refrigerators and ice boxes, I suppose they were called back then, and these 4,000 rather revoltingly colored little ochre and lime green and pink radio sets, each the size, as I said, of a packet of cigarettes, that's all they wanted. And the New York Times reported that the thieves seemed particularly discerning and only took these Sony radios because they had the little word Sony on them, which was up to that point hitherto unfamiliar. And New York Times readers said, well, if it's good enough for the burglars, it's good enough for us. And they bought them, they ordered them in the thousands.
Later that would have been a marketing genius. So
I still to this day think,
you wonder.
I think it was Sony that organized
you
the
do.
Raid.
You really do.
Well, cynically. Yes.
So you know, during Sony's ascendancy, we were so fearful of the Japanese economic strength and this name Sony. Little did I know at the time that Sony the name, the word, in a way came from the GIs who were occupying Japan after World War II.
It was a combination that they needed a four-letter word. They didn't want initials. Their company, Ibuka and Morita had started, it was initially called TTK. So, no, there was NBC and CBS, sure, and WGN and so forth. And they thought that wasn't good enough. The genius word was, of course, Kodak. It had to be made up, and it had to be probably two syllables. And the GIs would throw chewing gum in the occupation forces to the little children and say, there you are, sunny boy. And then someone remembered that sonos, the Latin for sound, and after all this, what this company was trying to do, despite the failure of the rice cooker, was to make tape recorders. That was what their initial business was. So they were to do with sound, and suddenly someone came up with the idea Sonus and Sonny Boy, and it was a friendly word. Let's call it S-O-N-Y. And Sony was born.
There it is. And then one more Sony story, and this is about the Walkman. I was in high school in the late 70s and early 80s. Walkman just coming in there. They seemed to be ubiquitous. They were everywhere. And little did I know that Sony at the time didn't have the money to market them.
Didn't have any money at all. And this was another Ibuka invention. I mean, he was a great inventor. He invented the Walkman. He invented the Trinitron television tube. He invented the Betamax recorder. Not so successful, of course. But the Walkman, what they would do was they shipped some Walkmans over, or Walkmen, I'm not sure what the plural of Walkman is, over to New York, and they would give them to pretty girls and secretaries and so forth in the Sony offices and get them to do things like going roller skating in Central Park with earphones on and this little device, you know, clipped onto their blouse or their skirt belt. And people would stop them and say, what's that? Oh, it's do you not have one yet? Well, easily available, you know, 1-800-SONY or something. And that word of mouth was an enormous marketing success.
So marketing like that might lend you to believe that they did engineer the theft.
We go back to that. Yes, I think so. I'm afraid you're becoming as cynical as I am.
We're talking to Simon Winchester. His latest book is Pacific, where he takes through a number of essays a look at the greater Pacific region. He is the author of many wonderful books, including the one that's being made into a film now in Dublin. Tell me about this.
Yes, I mean, this is terribly exciting, breaking news. Mel Gibson has owned the movie rights ever since I sold them to him in 1998, so 18 years ago.
Wow.
And he's been wanting to make it, but as you know, he manages to offend all sorts of people in Hollywood who can turn on the financial spigots. But anyway, he's managed to pull a deal together, and it is being made now. They started principal photography on the first of...
The Professor and the Madman.
I beg your pardon. I should have said that. No, the Professor and the Madman.
Well.
It's being filmed in Dublin with Mel Gibson playing the professor of the book and the madman who contributed to the making of the Oxford English Dictionary, because that's at the core of the story, is being played by Sean Penn.
Wow, those are two big people.
Yes, I don't know what the demographics of your listenership is, but younger people know, if they watch Game of Thrones, a very nice young woman called Natalie Dormer, who apparently plays some queen who keeps taking her clothes off and now is dead or something. So she is playing in it, as is Jennifer Eale, E-H-L-E, who is, do you remember Elizabeth Bennet in the BBC production of Pride and Prejudice?
I do not.
Well, she was beautiful.
I bet she was.
Beautiful then and beautiful, although 30 years older.
Okay, so I've talked to a lot of authors. I've talked to you several times. And one of the true tests of patience or genius is the ability to let someone else make a movie of their book.
I know. It's.
How are you doing?
I'm going to Dublin in early November, and I'll be there for a week, and they've all warned me. They said, you know, you're more than welcome. We're honored to have the writer of this book on set. Please
no,
advise,
not.
Please be nice, but don't interfere.
They don't really want you there, Simon. They're being nice. What about the marriage, then, or the partnership of you and Mel Gibson when you sell something to someone who develops later a reputation? How do you feel about that?
Well, that's very interesting you'd ask that question, because already the Anti-Defamation League has been on to me, saying we, the ADL, do not believe that he has sufficiently apologized for those remarks he made when the police officer arrested him some years ago now. And consequently, this new movie of his, Heartbreak Ridge, which is getting extremely good reviews, the ADL is suggesting that people should boycott it, and I suspect the same thing is going to happen to me. So I've come up with what I think is a relatively sensible reply, I mean, which I believe in too, which is, I wish Mel Gibson hadn't said what he said, but this story in The Professor and the Madman is a story of redemption. So I hope that will make the ADL say, Okay, that's reasonable. Anyway, I had nothing to do with it.
In a way, your success or the success of your book is tied to something you have no control over.
No, and I don't even have the ability contractually to take it back from him because the sale of the book rights to him was made in 1998, long before he said these unfortunate things.
Well, wish for the best, Simon Winchester. It's great to see you again.
And it's lovely to be with you, too.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.